Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. A reminder, we Zoom the day before, so if something should happen on Thursday night, we will not be discussing it during our Friday segment. Before I grab Scott Braddock, our favorite human being on the planet from Texas, I want to remind everyone that we begin with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment trials in 2019. We have a patriot. That's what he is. He's the definition of a patriot. He's got courage. He is why America has the potential to be great again, because we have people like Colonel Vindman in our midst. So now, the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
All right. If it's Friday, it must be Scott Braddock. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report, affectionately known as the Voice of Texas, the Dean of the Austin Press Corps. And I shared with our good friend Scott that I'm going to ask him to do a lot of heavy lifting today because I'm not feeling very well. But he's so reliable. I could not give up my conversation with him, especially because Donald Trump was in Texas this week. And you sent out some amazing tweets with some photos in it that were just devastating in a lot of ways because they really sort of speak the story of the country. But remind my audience, so why did Donald make the schlep to Texas?
Well, he was in Texas to remind people in the Permian Basin, who are probably about as conservative as people come, that he wanted to send a message, a clear message, as he put it, to the, quote, zealots, radicals, extremists who are trying to shut down your industry. Of course, in West Texas, the industry is oil and gas. As we talked this morning, Arnie, here on Thursday, the price of oil is, it's been moving down once again. I was looking at the oil futures. We're at $40 a barrel now, which is, you know, better than we had been earlier in the year. That's with President Trump in office. I want to underscore one thing for people before I say anything else about this. So much of the argument that I hear against Joe Biden, and I heard a lot of this as I was covering the Texas Republican Party convention a couple of weekends ago at this point. I worked 14 days straight, so everything is running together on me now. But during the RPT online convention, talking with some of the grassroots activists, and they would say, you know, forget Joe Biden, he's the worst. And I would say, well, what do you think is going to happen? Well, they would say that, you know, the whole country is going to be like Portland. Which, you know, I think Portland's actually pretty nice. I think they have, you know, a little uprising going on with like one or two city blocks, but that's been so amplified by the President of the United States, you know, and actually amping people up by sending federal, you know, officers in to do things that a lot of people have questioned. But the oil and gas industry has suffered with Trump in office, and I'm going to say this as a guy from Texas. If Texas was its own country, we'd be one of the leading producers for oil and gas, of course. This is a huge industry for our state. The president had bragged that he had a good relationship with Russia, right? Mm-hmm. Did that do us any good as Russia and the Saudis went to war with each other over the price of oil, flooding the market and creating a terrible situation back here in energy states, those states that tend to vote for Republicans, right? So you take that argument right off the table as the president comes here. He said that Biden would destroy the fracking industry that has doubled production in the Permian Basin. Of course, that's the area in West Texas around Midland, Odessa. Yeah. He said that, I don't think Biden's going to do too well in Texas. He has already written it off. Now, I also, for this event yesterday, don't think there was much message discipline, because while the president is saying that Biden has written off the state, Senator Ted Cruz, our junior senator, said, quote, Texas is in play. This is at the same event. Texas is in play. The whole country is divided right now. That's what Cruz said. He said the hard left is angry. He said, I think we're going to win Texas, but the president's not doing well in the suburbs right now.
What are the last polling? Isn't the last polling having literally in a dead heat?
Well, we have a lot of polls in a row now. I'm trying to remember how many, five or six polls that show that they are either in a dead heat or Biden is slightly ahead in Texas. I still don't quite believe that, but I will tell you, Arnie, that based on some of my conversations with political professionals in Texas, Republicans are very concerned, more than I've ever heard them concerned, in 20 years of covering Texas politics. They're worried about losing, a statewide office potentially, whether it be the U.S. Senate race or the presidency. Here's the difference. I think it's not so much that Republicans are thinking that, Joe Biden is going to come in and, have this message that's going to have something that resonates with people in Texas. They're not worried about Biden winning. They're worried about Trump losing. And that's different. There's a difference. You think about, go back to the 2016 election, and, it's the norm that the Republican candidate for president, the nominee for the Republicans, should win Texas by double digits. That was the case for former Governor Bush. That was the case for Mitt Romney. That was the case for McCain. No matter what happened around the rest of the country, the Republicans are rock solid in Texas, double digit victories. But Trump only won by 9 points. Now, that's in some places, and in some cases, you would say, well, that's still a blowout. That's almost a 10-point victory. But it's moving in the wrong direction for the Republicans in Texas. Texas is the biggest Republican state with 38 electoral votes. There is almost no path, and maybe no path, to the presidency for Republicans without the state of Texas in their corner. You go down the list of states that are said to be in play, you got North Carolina, you got Florida, you got Ohio, you got some of the normal swing states. But then you also, at the end of some Republican professional Republicans' lists, is Texas. And so they're concerned about that. The polling right now, I've seen some internal polling that shows that Texas Democrats are doing very well in various Texas House districts around the state, largely based on what's happening in the national environment. In a situation like this, where the stakes are so high and people are suffering, it's all about national politics. I mean, if you're somebody who's running for re-election to the Texas House or the Texas Senate or to Congress, I mean, at least if you're running for Congress, you're talking about national issues. That's what your message is about. Anyway,
let's think about
what the argument was.
Don't distinguish between the national and the local and the state, given the fact that we're in the middle of a pandemic, given the economic downturn, all these things bleed together. I just saw a candidate for governor being asked, well, do you think Congress should increase the unemployment benefits and keep the $600? And I mean, it's like, well, that's, he has no control over that.
Uh-huh.
That's not,
but
his,
he can't say that. He can't say that, right? He needs to have an opinion about it, right? He needs to say, here's what I think people ought to do. I know that people are hurting, and I would work with our congressional delegation to do XYZ, whatever that would be. I mean, that's the right answer for that, right? Think about the big prize in Texas that we've all been talking about. We talked about here on The Attitude with Arnie Arneson for months, is that the Texas House of Representatives is in play, that one of the pillars of state government in Texas could go back to the Democrats, that there could be a Democratic speaker in Austin come January when we might be having a legislative session during a pandemic. By the way, we have an in-depth report for everybody at quorumreport.com right now about what a legislative session would look like during a pandemic. The idea that government needs to be open, it's got to be, but you also have to keep people safe. So this is going to be a very interesting balance. Looking at some of these polls, I'll share with your listeners some of what I've seen. It looks like Biden, and I have looked at presidential numbers in different parts of Texas, and parts of Texas where Democrats either are defending legislative seats, or they see swing seats, just basically toss-up seats, or in seats where if Democrats were able to win, then they see these seats as bellwethers, this means the whole state's going to go Democratic.
Exactly.
The numbers they're seeing right now, and of course it's still early, people haven't really leaned in yet and put their shoulder into these campaigns just yet for November, but the old idea that campaigns can wait until after Labor Day, that's out the window. Right. I mean, these things are going on right now. People want to know what people in office would do right now, because a lot of people are at home and don't have anything else to do. Right. I mean, they're even more tuned in. It's interesting. You might not think they'd be interested in what's happening in politics and government. But in Texas, if you think about it, we kind of have this idea that Texas government is supposed to be sort of hands off. We're all about free market. We're all about letting, business do what it does and kind of staying out of people's lives for the most part, although, of course, there are issues where there are exceptions. But That's the general sense of government in Texas. But right now, the governor is ordering people to wear a mask or face a fine. Texans have not seen a state government as involved in their day-to-day life as they're seeing right now. So they're very tuned into what's going on with it, and they're very interested in what's happening with it. And you have this polling that shows that Biden is just doing very well in all those districts that I described. I mean, numbers that are astronomical for a Democrat running for president, or, you know, around 63%, 58% in some of these different places around the state. We're talking about the suburbs. We're talking about the places that are changing so rapidly, Arnie. Last week, we looked at the estimate from the comptroller, who is, of course, the accountant for the state. And the Republican comptroller talked about the fact that because of the downturn in the oil and gas industry that we talked about here at the beginning of the program, because of that, because of the slowdown in sales tax collections, the number one revenue generator for state government is sales tax collections. Right. And because consumption dropped like a rock, you're seeing the GDP numbers today coming out of Washington, where we just saw record numbers for the way that the second quarter numbers dropped. The same thing here in Texas. We are facing at least about a $5 billion shortfall when lawmakers come back to Austin in January. But one thing that was interesting about all of this, even during the pandemic, as they were looking at the economic activity, people are still moving to Texas, and still moving to Texas at an incredible rate. Before the pandemic, about 1,200 people would move to Texas every day from other parts of the country and the world. And that's mostly legal migration, people coming from other states. Some of that is undocumented folks coming in. But as the economy in the United States slows down, undocumented immigration, that slows down as well, because why do people come here? They come here for, you know, for jobs. There was one point when Governor Perry, I believe when he was first energy secretary, don't quote me on that, but at one point Governor Perry had said, the former governor had said that, you know, illegal immigration, he's like, that'll work itself out. Once we have robust economies on both sides of the border, you won't have to worry about that. And he was talking about the expansion.
Right.
He was talking mainly about the expansion of the oil and gas industry in Mexico. Right.
Okay,
so he, you know, the people have good jobs in Mexico. Why would they come here? Arnie, I haven't seen anything like this. So I think the telltale vote for what Texas looks like and what the real battlegrounds in the suburbs look like is the vote to take Confederate statues down in Washington last week. It happened after we talked. I think it happened the evening after we talked. But I was looking at the roll call on that, and my eyes bugged out. I couldn't believe some of the Republicans who were voting, Texas Republicans, who were voting to take down Confederate monuments in Washington. And then, of course, some Democrats around here joked, now do the Texas Capitol as well. Of course, this only passed in the House of Representatives in Washington, right? As I looked at the list, it's the suburban Republicans like Dan Crenshaw, who's from the Houston area, who's you know, one of these supposedly rock star Republicans. You know, he's the guy on Saturday Night Live with Pete Davidson, and they had that whole back and forth about Crenshaw's disability, the fact that he has one eye because he suffered from an explosion in the theater of war, and Davidson had made fun of that. And Crenshaw actually, you know, had a funny response to it, and he gained all this sort of bipartisan credit for being somebody who would come in and laugh at himself and have a good time and try to foster good relations with people who he doesn't necessarily agree with. But he's still a pretty conservative guy. He was at a Tea Party event with the little governor, Dan Patrick, a few weeks ago, in which they did not do any kind of physical distancing or mask wearing or anything like that. This is a guy who appears at a Tea Party, right? This is Texas politics in a nutshell in 2020. This is a congressman who goes to Tea Party events, but also voted to take down Confederate monuments last week.
Yeah.
What are the poll numbers looking like? What are the poll numbers looking like in those districts? Well, I can give you a sense of it. If you poll Republicans only about taking down Confederate monuments, you're talking about something that they would run you out of the room. Okay, the Republican Party in this state, the grassroots, if you poll Republicans, only about 11 or 12% would agree with that vote to take those Confederate monuments.
The Party of Lincoln, everyone.
It's a grassroots party for Republicans in Texas. To, quote, preserve our monuments in our history is a grassroots priority. So looking at some of the other votes for that piece of legislation, up in Collin County, which is north of Dallas, it's one of the suburban areas where Plano, Texas is there. That's the biggest city there. The congressman for Collin County, his district basically is that county. He voted yes. A guy named Van Taylor voted to take down Confederate monuments. Right next door in Denton County, another suburban county of Dallas-Fort Worth, Michael Burgess also voted yes. Pete Olson from Fort Bend County in the Houston area voted yes on that. And Will Hurd, who, as you know, is retiring and has been, he's made his brand on being more of a centrist Republican. He also voted yes on that. But it's very telling, the Republicans who are coming back are saying no to their grassroots. And think about those areas, Arnie, as we've talked about, with all these people moving to Texas, where are they moving? They're moving to the suburbs. They are rapidly diversifying. And I think that vote also tells us something about the way the messaging is playing so far in this whole debate over what is going on with civil unrest.
They want to be on the right side of history, Scott. I'm telling you.
They want to be on the right
side. They want to be in a party that will still be standing, not the Trump party, but another party. And if they don't sort of vote for those monuments to be removed, they're so aligning themselves in every way, shape, or form with Donald Trump that if there is a new version of the GOP, they are not going to be players in it because this is their legacy.
They want to be on the right side of history, but they also don't want to be on the wrong side of their voters. And and those voters are rapidly diversifying, as I said. Those 1,000 people moving to Texas every day, most of them are moving to the Texas suburbs. We just had Tesla last week. Elon Musk announced that he was going to build a new auto plant in the Austin area. 5,000 jobs, and that'll have a ripple effect through the economy here in Austin. Of course, we've had the governor and the Texas Republican Party chairman always bad-mouthing Austin as being, you know, this liberal, communist, socialist, Marxist area. And yet that's, but at the same time, they're praising Elon Musk for relocating his facility, of building this giant new facility in Austin. So I do think that these areas in suburban Texas are really the place where the battle is going to play out. And I'm sure we've talked about it. Rural Texas, you know, out in the country, my folks, where I'm from, those folks are more Republican than they have ever been. It's hard to imagine that they would be, because you would think that people in the rural parts of the state would already be as Republican as they could be. But if you looked at the election results from 2018, go back to 2016, and go back to the last midterm in 2014, they're trending more Republican all the time. More Republican all the time. Some of these counties, Arnie, that saved Ted Cruz's skin
against Beto
when he was running against Beto O'Rourke, some of these counties went from 70% Republican to like 83 and 85% Republican. And
oh,
if you looked
God.
At the end of Cruz's campaign, if you looked at the end of Cruz's campaign for re-election statewide in Texas last time, he at the end, right at the, I mean, in the last 4 weeks, the last month, I mean, they really got the message that they needed to shore up the rural vote because they were getting killed, not just in the major urban centers, but the suburban areas as well. They were losing those counties. They were losing Tarrant County, where Fort Worth is. They were losing Collin County, where Plano is, Denton County, and some of these other places that have been Republican power bases were swiftly moving to the Democrats. And so on election night, you may remember, when the first returns came out of Texas, only the biggest counties report their numbers first.
Right.
They have the ability to do that. We have a big challenge in reporting election results out of Texas because we have 254 counties and our election system is dispersed across the counties. When the election results first came in, O'Rourke was winning.
I know. I remember. Oh my God. But
and the Republicans were just freaked out. But that's because the rural votes hadn't come in yet. And so they said, wait. The rural vote in Texas will be the backstop for the Republicans, and that's where John Cornyn's going to have to work really hard. That's where other statewide officials will have to work really hard. The members of the Texas Supreme Court who are up for re-election, they'll have to work really hard in those rural areas. And at the end of that campaign for Cruz, suddenly instead of being in the big Texas cities that you've heard of, like Dallas and Houston and San Antonio, et cetera, he was in places you've never heard of, or may have, but you know, places in deep East Texas. He was also out in Amarillo and Lubbock and Texarkana, and just trying to shore up any votes that he could.
What you're describing to me is the most divided country
we've
ever seen, and that's just amazing. So I have to talk to you about Louis Gohmert. I have to talk to you about Louis,
of course,
because I mean, and now he's blaming the mask for giving him COVID-19. The level of denial about this pandemic. I hear his staff is wild with him because they feel like he's created a level of vulnerability for every one of them, and that's not what they signed in on. What is the reaction in Texas? He was supposed to hitchhike with Donald Trump when he flew into Texas, but he was tested that morning, and they found out that he was COVID positive. So, you know, the story is rippling out everywhere, and everyone's like, oh, I hope he's safe, I hope he's safe. No, I hope he's hermetically sealed. That's what I hope about him, because what he was for his office, he is a spreader. That's what he is. And he even demanded them or actually made fun of them when they wore masks in his office. So he has really sort of set an incredibly low bar about safety because not only is he a problem, but he is now a problem for not only other members of the House of Representatives, but for his staff. So what are they saying in Texas?
Well, let me start with one thing that was said in Washington. And as you know, the first standing order of the presiding officer of a legislative body is to protect the institution. And now that includes from disease. The Speaker of the House immediately said everyone is required to wear a mask, staffers and members of Congress as well. Gohmert had, as you said, just mocked people for wearing the mask. And then after he was revealed to have the mask, have the disease, he said that, you know, maybe the mask gave him the disease. It's a story of two Americas, though, Arnie. Why was he tested? He was tested and got rapid testing, reliable testing, and immediate results because he was about to see the President of the United States.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, but
in Midland, right? So, for you and I, we wouldn't get testing like that. We would get testing where we would have to wait for 10 or 15 business days, and which is completely just not acceptable and unhelpful and doesn't tell you anything, you know, to get, if you have testing, you can't get the results back. And remember, the President had said that if you want to test, you'll get a test. That did not work out that way. Well, a lot of people are getting tests. Well, maybe he was telling the truth that everybody could get a test, but maybe he left out that you would ever get results, right? I mean, 15 days later doesn't tell you anything because you've come into contact with people in that time. You've been, you know, going to the grocery store or doing right. whatever else in that time. And so if you test positive, but it's 15 business days later, which in reality, calendar days, that could be 24 days later. Yeah. You have no idea where you got it or how you got it if you've gone to any different locations or been in contact with anybody. So the reaction in Texas, look, Democrats around here, they're still pretty nice folks. You know, they wish the congressman well. They hope that he has a speedy recovery, and they hope that he doesn't ever really have symptoms from the disease. He's said to be asymptomatic right now. But as you said—
But at the very beginning, you are asymptomatic because you don't even know you have the illness, which is why when he was tested, he was so surprised.
Right. So we'll see. So people from East Texas, where Judge Gohmert is from, he was a judge previously in a previous political life.
Oh, my God.
you would have loved to sit in Judge Gohmert's courtroom. But where Judge Gohmert is from, Smith County, which is Tyler, Texas. Wonderful people and thoughtful people in Texas, mostly Republicans, but some Democrats too, are from deep East Texas, Arnie. And it is quite the amazing irony that they're represented by this guy. And in Congress, they keep sending him on back. I can't imagine that they won't keep doing it, you know, unless something
tragic happens.
Unless something tragic happens, which no one wants.
But that's the pandemic. The pandemic doesn't look at your party label.
The pandemic doesn't care about that.
I know. It just I only have a few minutes left. You put out a tweet, and you shared it with me, and it was a tweet. You shared a tweet from Donald Trump, and we have to talk about this in part because we only have a few minutes left, and it's the end of the week. Donald Trump writes, "With universal mail-in voting, not absentee voting, which is good, 2020 will be the most inaccurate and fraudulent election in history. It'll be a great embarrassment to the USA. Delay the election until people can properly secure and safely vote." Now, let me just say something. I wrote, "The coup has begun." That's what I wrote when I retweeted it. But this is more important. He knows about the pandemic. He's using the pandemic. But look at what he's doing. He doesn't use the pandemic to make us healthy. He doesn't use the pandemic to make sure that we have enough tests. He doesn't use the pandemic to address the needs of the 50 states and what's happening. He's using the pandemic to use as an excuse for delaying the vote. This is kind of like a smorgasbord. When I like it, I'll eat it. When I don't, I'll leave it on the table. Well, that's exactly what he's doing with the pandemic. If you want a delayed vote, then you show me why you haven't made sure that all of us don't get 24-hour or 2-hour testing because you don't care about us. You don't really care about the pandemic, but suddenly you're riding that one up and down the flagpole for an election day. What a crock of you-know-what.
Suddenly he cares about the health of everybody and wants to make sure that none of us get sick from COVID-19. Maybe we should just wait, or we could do other things like allow people to mail in their ballots, which some states just do that. We have a very successful mail ballot program in Texas. Of course, it's Republicans that are very good at it. You know where else Republicans are very good at mailing ballots is Florida. They've been very successful with their mailing program in Florida. It's always that Democrats have to catch up on election day in Florida because the Republicans are so good at absentee ballots in that key swing state. At some point, you start to believe, Arnie, that when someone doesn't want to expand the franchise and make sure that as many people can vote as possible, it's not that they're afraid of the method of voting, it's they're afraid of the voters.
Right, right. They're afraid of the result that the voters will then produce. So therefore, in order to make sure that they get to pick their voters, not the voters pick their politicians and their leaders, that's exactly what Donald Trump is doing. But notice what he said. Absentee voting is good. Mail-in voting is bad. Now, I want to remind everyone, when you vote absentee, you mail it in. You mail it in. In my state of New Hampshire, every single person can claim a disability for the purposes of getting an absentee ballot. And you could literally have 100% mail-in voting because all of us can claim we're afraid of COVID. So look what he's doing, though. It's so interesting because what are the states that are proposing mail-in voting? Take a look at the states that already have it now. They've been doing fine, but all of a sudden now he's saying, no, it's fraudulent. Now, this is a come-to-Jesus moment, but because the pandemic is giving him an opportunity to use this again as another divisive wedge.
Yeah, the fight for mail-in voting, probably over here in Texas, so for expansion of voting by mail. There have been some court challenges on that, but I can tell you that Democratic campaigns have basically at this point accepted the fact that the battlefield is set when it comes to that they're not going to be able to, you know, expand mail ballots. And we saw in a July 14th runoff earlier this month, we had almost 1 million people vote in the Democratic runoff for the U.S. Senate. Those are astronomical numbers. The last time there were any numbers similar to that for people voting in Texas in the middle of July, when it wasn't a pandemic, was back in 2012, when Senator Ted Cruz and the former Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst faced off for the U.S. Senate. And of course, we know which party won that fall when the time came for the general election.
Well, Scott Braddock, thank you so much. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report, the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps. He carried me today because I'm not feeling well, and I so appreciate it. And there's so much happening in Texas. And I just need to say one more thing. When Donald Trump basically sort of wants to delay the vote, he's looking for anything to distract us from what's happening with the pandemic and the economy. This is another way he's throwing the coin into the water, saying, go down and follow that. This is what's so frightening. It means that we're not focusing on the issues of the moment. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll talk to you next week.
A new job description for the ubiquitous ditch. On this current cast.
Roadside ditches crisscross every watershed. They're everywhere.
That's Rebecca Schneider of Cornell University. She says ditches move water so quickly they cause flooding downstream and dry out the area upstream. Ditches also wash excess nutrients and sediment into streams. But changing how ditches are managed can help. Schneider says that sending the water into a wetland, lining the ditches with vegetation, and making them more shallow and wide would help to slow the water.
If we can replumb the watershed, disconnect ditches from streams, we can reduce flooding, we can reduce water pollution, and help with drought.
So with a little makeover, ditches could be providing a multitude of benefits. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
All right, gang, we're going to do a old show about voting by mail, believe it or not, and the challenges for the USPS, because I am not feeling well, and I don't want to conduct an interview when I can't be engaged with my fabulous guests. So stick around. More information about the United States Postal Service and your vote.
I was looking at ProPublica, which I go to on a regular basis. Joining us right now is Ryan McCarthy. Ryan, this piece was... This piece needs to be discussed on 60 Minutes. This piece needs to be discussed on MSNBC. It's sobering and important. And as we are so frightened about what's going to happen in November with the election, everyone keeps talking about the fact that the answer to this, in order to make people safe and make sure that they protect the integrity of the vote, is that they should do mail voting. And then I read your piece. I was so depressed. And I want you to talk about what you discovered about the Postal Service, what you discovered about the challenges of mail-in voting, and more importantly, what I realized by the end of your piece, which is incredibly extensive, is that if you've developed the muscle of mail-in voting, because you've been doing it for years, you're pretty good at it, because it requires time, energy, relationship with the Postal Service. You know how to do the system because you've done it over and over again. Well, if we suddenly turn the switch on and ask a lot of states that have never freaking done this before to do it, we're going to be really disappointed. So let me welcome Ryan McCarthy to the program. And Ryan, before you worked for ProPublica, can you just share with my audience a little bit about your experience? Because this, you're not new to this game. You've been doing it for a while.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm really glad to be here and to talk about a really important topic. Yeah, so my background before joining ProPublica, I was the editor-in-chief of Vice News, where I helped run their newsroom and helped launch Vice News Tonight on HBO. And prior to that, I worked at the Washington Post and the New York Times and Reuters, and excited to be covering the election for ProPublica this year.
Well, I'm beyond thrilled because you did a phenomenal job. All right, so the article on ProPublica was entitled, ready for this? The Postal Service is steadily getting worse. We kind of knew that. Donald Trump wants them to disappear anyway, and we know that they're practically bankrupt because of what happened in 2006. But anyway, and then the question is, so if it's getting worse, can it handle a national mail-in election? And then this is the subtitle. Postal delays and mistakes have marred primary voting, and after years of budget cuts and plant closures, mail delivery has slowed so much that ballot deadlines in many states are no longer realistic. Just begin at the beginning. I read this piece and I was physically nauseous because it's incredibly sobering, as I am a big supporter of mail-in voting.
Yep.
I'm not sure that it is the answer given what you uncovered. So why don't you walk through this?
Sure.
And tell, give me some hope.
So here's the good news. We'll start with the good news.
Okay.
The good news is, I think you're right. There are states who have developed the muscles to do voting by mail. And those muscles have been built up, in some cases, over a decade. And they've moved slowly to develop a system, which is a complicated system. And it's like running a large business, sending out millions and millions of ballots to voters. Places like Colorado and Utah and Washington and Oregon do this really well, but they do this knowing that they're working with a postal service that may not be the postal service you and I would imagine. You know, if we mail a letter, we're pretty reasonably assured it's going to get there relatively on time. Unfortunately, the Postal Service has been hit by over a decade of cutbacks and plant closures that have slowed delivery times. And in fact, they have slowed the delivery times consciously because they just couldn't keep up for first-class mail. And most election mail is sent first-class mail. And so what does that mean? That means that, you know, about, according to an audit from 2018, about 95% of election mail gets delivered on time nationally. And in some ways, that's pretty good, right? But if you project that over to a national election where you have tens of millions of vote-by-mail ballots, 5% or 6% or 4% of ballots coming in late could be a colossal disaster. And it could be just wildly confusing to voters. And there's another part of this too, which is that election experts have been warning for years about the need to adjust ballot deadlines and election operations to this slower, more cash-strapped postal service. And the cash-strapped thing is actually really key. In April, they went to Congress and said, we're going to run out of money by September, in part because of the losses related to COVID. And so without that funding, they may not be able to make payroll in September by their own admission. And now there's some evidence that they are doing better as more people shop online since then. But the truth is, a lot of our election laws and a lot of our election logistics around vote by mail have been built with a different postal service in mind, one that is faster and more capable. And in some cases, these vote by mail systems are catered towards people, a small section of each state's population who already vote by mail and already know the rules. Knowing the rules and knowing how long mail takes is going to be a big challenge for election officials this year. That voter education piece is going to
be tough. So voter education is going to be key, but it sounds like where you have to start is with Secretary of State education. And if you don't start with the Secretary, I get it. I mean, I've been an elected official, so I know how these boys operate. So what I'm reading from your article is that, so it's not your father's post office. It's now a new system. It's delayed. It's the middle of a pandemic. Some of their people are sick. On top of that, you got the plant closures. So that means instead of it going to like the plant that used to be 50 miles away, maybe go to a plant that's 150 miles away, which takes it that much longer to get to. They may lose things in the system because there aren't enough people doing all the other. I mean, your article was just horrifying. I'm just telling you right now, horrifying. It's great. But what I'm hearing is that the first thing that needs to happen to sober people up is, before you educate me, you've got to educate the Secretary of State. And that means that the decision, if assuming any kind of vote by mail or absentee balloting, which, for example, in my state, I'll give you an example of my state versus the state of Texas, because that's two states that I cover pretty closely. My state has always been pretty rigid about absentee balloting. But this year, they decided fear of COVID-19 was a disability for the purposes of absentee balloting, which means we all have it because we're all afraid, right. Which means technically we could all absentee ballot, which really is vote by mail, you know, but that's not what they call it. You still have voting available on election day, but for the most part, you're going to see a huge spike in vote by mail. In the state of Texas, they don't call it a disability. You can do some absentee balloting, but they're going to basically just extend the amount of time that you have to vote in person. So that's the way they're doing it versus the way we're doing it. But there's going to be a variation in every theme. But for the most part, you're going to still see, I think, a significant spike in people voting by mail in some way, no matter how you call it. So when you were doing your research and you were talking to the post office and the post people, I know they want to protect the integrity of what they do. And I know want everyone to think they do a great job, even though they're starving and they're underfunded. But are they willing to be honest and have a real sit down with every Secretary of State? Because even if they don't do across the board mail-in voting, you see a huge spike in people still voting in that way in some capacity. Have they started the conversations now?
I think they have. I think it is fair to say they have started those conversations. One thing that my article mentions is a pretty unique series of warnings, including one warning that a USPS official sent to every election administrator in the state of Ohio, essentially warning that their deadlines for requesting an absentee ballot didn't fit with the new reality of the Postal Service. Ohio made, frankly, the mistake of letting voters request a ballot up until noon on the Saturday before a Tuesday election, which, of course, is not enough time to put it back in the mail. And so I think the USPS actually took an active step to warn officials, including the Secretary of State, on that. And USPS has been good about putting election mail coordinators in front of Secretaries of State. Where it maybe hasn't been good is really being honest about just how badly its service has deteriorated over the years. You know, it hasn't hit any of its goals for any of its first-class mail categories in 5 years. It's been deteriorating for the better part of a decade. And I think people deserve to know that. And the U.S. Postal Service is sort of this iconic and frankly essential part of American life. But it's hard to look at its own data and its own goals and say it's really living up to all it could be.
Can I say something? I think it's completely true. And there are huge problems with the Postal Service's ability to do what it needs to do to make mail-in balloting work this November. But I think that one perspective that we should be talking about is who's responsible. When people go to the polls and vote, there are only two entities. There's the ballot clerk and the state there, and there's us, the voter. And we go, and if we fail to get there before they lock the doors, we're out. And if their machines don't work, it's their responsibility to find us another way to vote. But now with this mail-in voting, there's three entities. There's the Postal Service in between, and they're a completely separate entity. I mean, if we had FedEx doing it, it's not their responsibility, the Postal Service's responsibility to figure out how to make voting work. It's the state's responsibility to make sure that people in their state can vote. And they should be guaranteeing that there's a way to make that happen so that people are safe. So I think that trifecta of responsibility is something that people aren't talking about much.
I think that's fair. I think that's really fair. And, you know, I think one of the tricky parts in reporting this out is the Postal Service isn't forthcoming either to states or local election administrators about what mistakes might have been and what happened. And they're not forthcoming with journalists like me either or readers. So I think it can be hard to intertwine where those three entities bear responsibility. But I think that's totally right. In some cases, we're treating the U.S. Postal Service like it should solve our electoral problems. And the truth is, it's not, even in its glory days, it couldn't have done that.
But it's not their job. It's the state's job.
So one of the things, as I'm reading your incredibly extensive article, is you're absolutely right. We should not expect the Postal Service to sort of answer our problems. We know there's a problem with elections. We know there's a problem with the pandemic. We know there's a problem with keeping people safe. We know there's a problem in exercising the franchise because one party wants people to vote, the other party wants voter suppression. And that's another sort of kettle of fish. And so part of the problem is that the Postal Service is now kind of the ping pong ball, you know, between the two parties that, you know, don't want to have a robust turnout and the party that wants to have a robust turnout, but a postal service may turn out to be not the robust turnout either. So, you know, one party is thinking, oh, this is our answer. And then I read your article, I'm going, gag me with a spoon. It may not be your answer. But here's my question. There is a problem right now because it is so depleted. There is a problem because it doesn't have personnel. There is a problem because they found, you know, 1,000 votes sitting on a table, you know, ballots sitting on a table that never got delivered, or, you know, they found 300 bundled in a mailbox. And so as I was reading this, it was like a horror story. Why aren't we creating, since it is not necessarily the Postal Service's responsibility, a separate system just for ballots? So you have your blue and red mailboxes, and then during election, you have another kind of a mailbox. It only comes out during election time. It comes out maybe 2 weeks before the election, and it has a big V on it to vote. And what you do is you put it in there, and that's the only thing that goes in there. And then some election officials, we hire personnel to pick them up and vote. Why aren't we doing that? That way we don't depend on the Postal Service that doesn't want to be as honest as it needs to be about the challenges they face, knowing that we don't have the relationship time to build up like they've done in Colorado and Utah and other places and Oregon. But if we don't, why aren't we creating a discrete system because of the pandemic, in fact? And it may turn out that this may be the answer over time, but because of the pandemic and the problems with the Postal Service, we need a third solution.
I'm glad you mentioned that because there are states that have systems that function a little bit like that, right? So one of the problems here, and this goes back to your point earlier, is the roadmap for developing best practices in vote by mail. It's actually pretty clear and pretty well trod. The states that have done this have a playbook, and they have things like intelligent mail, barcodes on your ballot that'll let you track it and let states and voters know where their ballot is. And drop-off boxes. In states, the big vote-by-mail states like Colorado and Washington, 60 to 70% of voters don't actually put their filled-out ballot in the mail. They put it in a designated drop-off box.
Yes!
Cutting the U.S. Postal Service out of the back end of the process. And that makes a ton of sense, but especially in these rushed early primaries in places like Wisconsin and Georgia and Ohio, they just haven't built up these very, like, very well understood best practices yet. And it's really hurting voters. I think the USPS's official advice is mail your, which I think a lot of voters just don't know, certainly this year, is to mail your ballot in at least 7 days ahead of your state's election. Now, I personally don't know anyone who wants to vote that way, right? The last week of election could have some useful information.
Exactly.
If not for the presidential election, then other ballot races, certainly. And ballot drop-off boxes obviate the need for that, for putting in 7 days.
So I keep thinking about, we didn't have ventilators. Then all of a sudden, we all figured out how to make ventilators. You know, we didn't have swabs. And then all of a sudden, we figured out how to make swabs. Well, we're just talking about a little metal box. We're not talking about something that, you know, NASA's going to send up to outer space. We're talking about something that I could build. So, I mean, it's, you know, I'm being funny, but I'm being so powerfully serious. Because you could put a vote box where every post box is. You could put a vote box where every postal office is. You could put, because you know where they are. And you know who can tell us? The Postal Service. They know where every one of their post boxes are. And we already have developed that muscle to go to the post box or to go to the post office. So guess what? It's not going to be teaching a bunch of 90-year-olds what to do because they already know what to do. And the learning curve is so tiny. So what I can't quite believe is that we haven't figured that out. And, you know, I know we're waiting for the federal government to, like, cut checks to help us out. But this isn't a very expensive thing to do. I mean, I want to call Bloomberg up and say, you know, you put away millions of dollars on that stupid election where you got like four votes. Do me a favor. Why don't you write grants to every state in the nation so they can put a damn post box in? It'll probably cost you less and you'll do a good thing for the country, you know? I know I sound like a little old lady who's crazy, but this takes a crazy idea that can be done and isn't so off the charts that it's not possible. And what scares me, Ryan, you're a brilliant writer. You're a great reporter. I can't be the only person to think this is the answer. And I can't be the only person who's sitting in her attic going, I think you should do this. Because in the end, it's only June. Mm-hmm. We can at least do it for November for sure. We may have blown it for some of the primaries, and I apologize for that. But right now, the real get to goal is what happens in November, and we have time to build those boxes. And we have
time
to
train
people about those boxes and train the Secretary of States to do it. And frankly, given that we have this time and the Postal Service can still partner with those Secretary of States about where to put those boxes, it could be a win-win, Ryan. And I'm just so terrified that this old bat in the attic is thinking about it in June. And why isn't this front and center and being thought about by every good government group, every Secretary of State? And why isn't it being designed now?
I think that's right. I think, you know, one of the surprising things that I learned in writing this was really just that this is kind of a brute force industry, voting and by mail. You know, when people hear the term absentee ballot, their eyes kind of glaze over because it sounds arcane just off the bat. But really, to your point about ballot drop-off boxes, this is a simple mechanical process for the most part. And, you know, if you look at the states that do it well, not only do they use drop-off boxes, but then they go into USPS facilities and hunt for ballots. They physically do a sweep.
Explain that to me. That's why compliment the states that have done it, because they've gotten it down to a science. But their science has included the Postal Service. So explain to me and to my audience what the idea of a sweep is, because they actually are allowed into where the Postal Service collects and sends out their mail. So tell me what they do.
Well, look, I spent in a previous career, I spent many years as a bartender and a waiter and working in kitchens in various fashions. And every night before you could leave, you had to do a sweep to make sure that you had cleaned every possible part of the kitchen and you know, dining room. And I think there's a similar impulse here, which is to say these massive mail facilities like the one in Denver mentioned in the article process millions of pieces of mail per day. And while we all wish to be automated like robots, the truth is some stuff is just going to get lost in the cracks. And some people are not going to get the message, and some stuff is going to come in late and be unbundled. And so that last, a literal, very like brute force mechanical process of hunting for ballots in a warehouse, in a USPS warehouse, can actually make sure that people's votes count. So I totally agree with you that this is sort of a will issue, a political will issue, and not necessarily just a factor of money. And it's also a matter of responsibility too, because if you look at what happened in Georgia this time around, you had the Republican Secretary of State blaming some of the counties, not all of the counties, but blaming the counties for what happened there and lack of training. And you almost got no one really wanting to step up and take responsibility for the disaster that happened in so many jurisdictions there. And I think that's sort of a metaphor for our decentralized election system in a lot of places. In Wisconsin, it's all municipal elections. So you had very different counting procedures for absentee ballots in some cases in one town as opposed to the other. So I think in some ways, what we're asking to do is sort of a collective action. Right? We're trying to make this massive shift to vote by mail as a nation in a system that has decentralized management and responsibility. And that's going to be really tough.
One of my closest friends runs elections in her little town. And we were talking about this, and she's sort of out of her mind. And she doesn't really like mail-in voting. She likes the idea of people coming in, but she's old. And she's got underlying health conditions. She has cancer. And everybody that works with her has underlying health conditions because they all have blue hair. So she's not so sure that she wants to actually have people voting. But she thinks in a lot of ways what's happening right now is the worst of all possible ideas. You're going to have some people showing up. You're going to have some people absentee balloting, which means it's going to require a lot more personnel to come in and open all those envelopes and then read all those numbers. Plus, she's going to still have to staff at the same time. I mean, if you're talking about local, it's even more chaotic than you could possibly imagine. I should give you her name. You should talk to her. Because
I'd love to.
No, she's so eloquent, but she also explains why now it's the worst of everything. And she actually needs more people to do even more things at a time when everyone's even more frightened. So in a lot of ways, you're not solving problems by having every kind of system in place. But knowing that, again, which is why I really want your piece on 60 Minutes. Which is why I want your piece on MSNBC and CNN, because it's so sobering, but it also, like Arnie with the bingo and the light over her head, goes, but there's an answer. And the answer is not threatening, and the answer is not sophisticated, and the answer kind of means that we have to sort of do it together, something that we don't always do so well. But I think people are realizing that they have a respect for the franchise. They also respect the pandemic and the fear of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. So they want people to be able to trust the outcome. And those little boxes that say vote on them next to every postal box is something people could understand and trust, because it's not a machine. It's them putting it in the box. And in a way, the less sophisticated and the more obvious, the more people are going to trust the result. And I am more afraid of trusting the result than almost anything else. And right now, I see only chaos going into November. And after reading your article, I see an answer to chaos. But I wouldn't have even known I needed an answer if I hadn't understood what was going on with the Postal Service and about the level of sophistication those states that have a history of working with the Postal Service have brought to the table that we just don't have the time to do with all the other states.
You know, the Postal Service actually has experience with dual boxes. I remember when they came out with express mail service, and they would have a separate box for the express mail. And everybody knew that it was in the same place as the regular box. And if you want to send it express mail, if you want to do it on election day as a vote, you put it in the separate box. So, you know, they've done it before. The other thing I wanted to say is, Brian, you were talking, tell me if you think this makes sense. You're talking about the primaries and all the problems with the primaries, and we don't want to have the same problem again. I think part of that problem is that the primaries were planned very quickly. COVID had just come on, and people hadn't made a commitment to do it one way. And now we have time for the powers that be to actually make decisions well enough in advance that, yes, indeed, we're going to do this by mail. And so how are we going to plan that? And then they read Ryan's article that says, well, we really can't depend on the Postal Service to make voting by mail happen if we go the usual route. So what do we need to do in order to make this work? But they have to make a commitment. And part of the problem is we have the president saying, I don't want to do it by mail because too many people might actually vote. So we don't know if it's going to be by mail or not by mail. But if we make a commitment to doing it, just the decision one way or the other as to how we're going to do it, and then we plan for how to make it work. And your article has closed the information gap, told us that there's this issue we have to deal with. Go deal with it. We can do it.
I think that's a very excellent point. And I think the issue of trust, which you both hit on earlier, is pretty important. I mean, keep in mind, the Postal Service has been demonized by Republicans and by Trump. And there are very good reasons why people wouldn't trust our election results, just given the polarization right now, particularly given what the president has said. And they may not trust those election results, particularly if they're delivered by the U.S. Postal Service. And so there's a twin problem there about legitimacy and process that folks just may not buy into depending on their political beliefs. So I think if we can get the power or get the systems being built by local, state and local officials who can get outside of some of these political footballs or these political minefields, then I think people will have a better chance at buying into whatever results happen. But the Postal Service, I have to tell you, is a toxic thing in Washington. Everyone professes to love it. No one wants to take on reforming it. And no one wants to get on, at least the Republicans don't want to get on the bad side of the president. So it's just sort of a quagmire.
Well, and the problem began in 2006 when they had to pre-fund the retirement, which is just insane. So this has been, it has been eroding for a long time. There isn't time, even if we cut them gazillion dollar checks, it couldn't fix what's wrong because you can't open new facilities and you can't hire enough people, and we're in the middle of a pandemic anyway. So I want to give them the funding. I want to repeal that 2006 requirement, but that's a systemic problem. That's a long-term solution.
Yeah.
We need a short-term practical solution. And I'm going to remind everyone that if we can send a man to the moon, and if we can, you know, we can do that amazing like thing that was just went up the other day by NASA and whatever, we can figure this out because it isn't rocket science, which is wonderful. And I think that's the other part that's just so perfect about your article, is that it takes the scale away off our eyes. It explains to us why we can't be Colorado, because we haven't had the time and the experience. So if we're not, what's the happy sort of medium in between those two? We're now a little more experienced with the pandemic, so we understand how to sort of, you know, mask up and social distance. We can also figure out how to sue some kind of mail-in voting. It may not be the U.S. Postal Service, but there may be another vehicle for us to do that that'll feel like the Postal Service, but ain't the Postal Service. So, Ryan McCarthy, you are fabulous. This is the most incredible article. The Postal Service is steadily getting worse. Can it handle a national mail-in election? I don't know how many shows you can get on. I don't know whether you can get on Bill Maher. I don't know whether you can get on every late night show, but it is an important story because it is so illustrative of the problem and explains it in a practical way, but it also then gives us opportunity to find a practical solution. And if that practical solution is possible, then we need to do it now. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, and stay safe.
All right, you too.
This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We'll schmooze on Monday. Thank you.
Let's go back, let's go back, let's go way on, way back when. I didn't even know you, you couldn't have been too much more than 10.